예수님. Fire stations are a vital community facility and they need to be located within the areas they serve. While predominantly used by firefighters, the stations also play an important role in the community that they serve. The fire service has a broad community purpose which needs to be recognised. Coupled with optimally located fire stations, which Mr McIntosh will talk to you about, are the key enabler to ensure an effective fire service operational capability is the provision of supporting infrastructure, sufficient firefighting water supplies, and access for fire service vehicles. To achieve effective operational capability and to ensure its statutory duties are enabled, the Commission requires the ability to construct and operate fire stations in locations which enable effective response times to fires and other emergencies within each community area, the ability to provide training facilities for firefighters and other emergency service workers as appropriate, the adequate supply of water for firefighting activities, and adequate access to new developments and subdivisions which ensure fire service can respond. The Commission has three key concerns in its submission, which will occur across a number of chapters of the district plan. And in summary, they are the need to ensure access to and the adequate supply of water, the need to ensure physical access to be able to respond to fires, and ensuring that emergency services are provided for as key community services and facilities throughout the plan. Important to ensure that the required infrastructure, such as fire stations, is provided for in a strategic sense throughout the plan, as well as practically in terms of development controls and rules. Planning for emergencies is quite common within district plans. For example, controls are often found in plans addressing flooding and earthquakes through controls on the types of activities that occur in ground shaking and floodplain areas, or additional requirements for development in those areas. For example, there are a number of rules within the proposed plan that prohibit activities due to flood risk or have flood risk as a matter for discretion, considering activity standards in terms of setback from water bodies. Although natural hazards is not defined within the proposed plan, fire is within the definition of natural hazards within the Resource Management Act, and it's submitted that planning for fire should be treated in a similar way as planning for other natural hazards. The Commission has sought this recognition in a range of ways through its submission, which includes new requirements for new subdivisions and residential activities in respect of physical access to properties and access to and the provision of water and the provision for construction and operation of fire stations in a range of zones. The New Zealand Fire Service Firefighting Water Supplies Code of Practice is the key document setting out requirements for water supply and access. In terms of the relief sought in respect of inclusion of reference to that code, as explained by Ms. McLeod, this is recognition of standard practice already occurring within this district. Fire stations are essential in providing emergency response to fire and other emergencies, as well as being a critical community facility. They need to be embedded within the communities they are servicing to ensure proximity and timely response. It's also a critical requirement to be able to access the properties to attend fires in order to put them out and to have adequate supplies of water to ensure that they're able to put out fires when they arrive. The implementation of those matters are dealt with at later stages of this hearing process, but was considered essential to provide that overview at the outset before discussing a specific relief sought in this chapter. So in this chapter, the Commission is seeking the insertion of a new objective and two supporting policies within the plan under Goal 3.2.6. So the objective would be to provide for the health and safety of people and communities by enabling emergency services, and two supporting policies, and to enable the development of ongoing use of emergency service facilities and to provide adequate property access and firefighting water to ensure efficient and effective emergency response. As the chairperson has already pointed out, this differs slightly from the relief sought in the original submission. And I explain that in the legal submissions, and we've already discussed that, so I'll skip over that part. the Section 42A report prepared the strategic direction chapter, did not address the Commission's original submission or its proposed objective. It simply recommended that the submission be declined and the table attached to the 42A report without any reasons given. The Commission disagrees with this, and as the reasons for rejection are unknown, is unable to respond directly to those. While the general approach taken in the plan recognises the provision of emergency services within communities, it is considered appropriate for recognition to be given at the highest level within this chapter. This is consistent with the approach taken by the Commission on a national basis and is consistent with the recent decision on the Christchurch Replacement District Plan and its Strategic Directions chapter. The provision of emergency services is at the heart of the statutory purpose of the Resource Management Act in terms of Section 5.2 and needs to be reflected. So in conclusion, it's submitted that it's appropriate for the importance of emergency services, which contribute to the sustainable management through enabling the health and safety of people and communities, is provided for and should be recognised in the Strategic Direction chapter of the plan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. First of all, I take it that if I have issues with the wording of the report, I should discuss those with Ms. McLeod.
Yes.
I do have one legal issue for you to address. Can you explain to me how the provision of firefighting water fits within the role of the district plan and QLDC's functions rather than those of the Otago Regional Council?
I might be a member of the issue as well, but it's considered that it's appropriate to address those issues at the subdivision stage, and that's within the Queensland Lakes District Council and the
Water and the provision of it and the ability to get it for firefighting a Section 14 matter, which is not a function of the council?
Yes, so Section 14.3 allows or provides that it's not a breach of the restrictions on the use of water if that's being used for emergency service. But in terms of the code, it's more making sure that water is there to be able to be used.
Is the issue more to do with rural subdivision than urban subdivision?
Mr. McIntosh might be able to deal with this, but the issue is generally where there's no adequate supply through a reticulated system, so it's ensuring that you have a tank or a non-reticulated source that is available to be accessed assist.
Is it an issue when there is reticulated water?
Again,
insufficient pressure?
It does depend on what is provided through that system and whether that system is adequate. And so Mr. McIntosh may be able to better address that from an operational perspective.
But just as a legal issue, I think, isn't it related to that it's under the Local Government Act that the council is required to provide water pressure to dwellings rather than something that's under the RMO?
And again, that's sort of in terms of the reticulated system. Yes, that's one of their functions under the Local Government Act, but it is an issue where there is no reticulated system or where that reticulated system isn't within council control.
Well, coming full circle, then, and this may well be an issue for Ms. McLeod, perhaps think about what we hear from Mr. McIntosh, that the word provide in your suggested policies at the kernel of the issues that the Commission is raising, and maybe you could think about how that could be tweaked, because on the face of it, I can't see how the district plan can provide water. It can make requirements that other people provide us, but I don't see how the district plan can provide it.
Yes, I understand that point. I guess it's also, it's more than just providing that water, it's providing for access to properties and access to that water supply as well.
Sorry, I haven't finished.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Is the CDEMA relevant in terms of your submissions at all? Civil Defence Emergency Management Act? Does that play a role in terms of...
That's probably more of a fire service question. But I think we're talking here more about the day-to-day management and response to fire, as opposed to in a civil defence emergency situation where you've got a slightly different framework to operate within and under.
And then the Fire Service Act, the functions that specifies, they just relate to the Fire Commission and Fire Service? Not? Are there any that the District Council does it have any functions or whatever?
No, so it sets up the sort of the role and duties and obligations of the fire service, and it's under that legislation that the code of practice has been created and put out, but it doesn't have, as far as I'm aware, it doesn't have any direct obligations in respect of District Councils. It does have provisions that provide for fire service to provide advice to councils in terms of other legislation, but in terms of direct obligations in the councils, I'm not aware of any.
Okay, thank you.
That's not something I've directly looked at.
Yes, thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Keith McIntosh. I'm the Area Manager for the New Zealand Fire Service in the Central Otago and North Otago area.
Mr. McIntosh, I could have explained this. We've pre-read all the evidence. A very short summary is all we need.
Sure, okay.
More than a page worth, probably, having read it all.
Right. Perhaps then I'll just cut to the key issues then.
Yes, that's
right.
Thank you.
So there are currently 6 fire stations located within the Queenstown Lakes District, Queenstown, Frankton, Arrowtown, Lake Hawea, Luggett and Wanaka. And we're currently constructing a new fire station on Valentine Road in Wanaka. The current facilities at Queenstown, Arrowtown, Lake Hawea and Luggett and the new facilities in Wanaka are considered to be sufficient currently to service the surrounding areas. The main issue we have within the Queenstown Lakes District is the adequacy of our facilities in Frankton. The existing station will need to be replaced in the medium term to meet increasing demands that development in this area is creating. Currently, the Frankton station is probably the second busiest single pump quality station in this region and is experiencing increasing call numbers. The existing station was built in 1975 on a small site of 1,077 square metres and was constructed as a single bay station attached to Queenstown. But the current brigade strength of 24 has far outgrown this, and the facilities do need to be replaced. So without adequate redevelopment of Frankton Station, the ability for fire service to efficiently and effectively respond will be compromised. So this underpins the need for appropriate activity status and the development controls within the plan to support this development elsewhere within Frankton. And just for your information, Frankton last year responded to 172 calls. New Zealand Fire Service can only provide the most effective service if fire stations are located in the centre of a turnout area that takes in the community they protect. The turnout area is determined in terms of response times. That is the time taken for an appliance to respond to the edge of the turnout area for the station. A fire station is strategically placed to meet or exceed the national service delivery guidelines in the area that it serves. It follows that the ability to locate fire stations in their optimum locations enables the New Zealand Fire Service to achieve these national service delivery guidelines. To achieve the optimum fire station location, this may mean that they are required to be located in all areas, including residential areas. They cannot always be placed in less sensitive environments because of the location of the fire station is necessary to enable the fire service to respond to emergencies in the surrounding area. Coupled with the optimally located fire stations, the key enabler to ensuring effective fire service operational capability is the provision of supporting infrastructure, namely well-designed transportation networks, adequate firefighting water supplies and access for fire service vehicles. Failure to provide suitable transport networks, adequate firefighting water supplies, both reticulated and non-reticulated, and access for fire service vehicles could result in unnecessary loss of life and can result in loss of property, including housing, community assets and infrastructure. It can also cause downstream economic, social and environmental losses. It places a higher degree of risk on those who rely on the fire service for help and assistance during an emergency. It can result in significantly greater risk to life, fire spreading to neighbouring property, community impact resulting from hazardous substances emergencies, disruption and economical loss to businesses and commerce, and places unnecessary risk to firefighters in terms of their safety. So inadequate infrastructure compromises the New Zealand Fire Service's ability to discharge its statutory functions and meet its response time guidelines. When considering fire risk, the provision of a readily available sufficient water supply will significantly affect the extent which a firefighting resource can save life and property. Should a fire occur, fire service will respond to the call and will commence firefighting operations using whatever water is available, including our own tank supply and fire appliances. The delays in accessing an adequate water supply allow a fire to continue to develop to a size that could result, or more likely to result, in a substantial loss. Of note, in a residential fire, fire can spread very rapidly and can result in complete loss within minutes once the fire is established, largely due to the combustibility of furnishings that's used today. So as I've already mentioned, the New Zealand Fire Service Firefighting Code of Water Supplies, Code of Practice for Water Supplies is really, really important. I don't think I need to really go into more detail about that. Moving to access to property, the time it takes to access a building from the road and the space available for firefighters to undertake firefighting or rescue operations can have a significant impact on what New Zealand Fire Service is able to achieve. And without adequate access, firefighters are severely restricted in the duties they can perform. The ability of firefighters to get resources to a site to position them safely and effectively directly impacts on the outcome of the emergency they are attending. And there are, in their submission, there's some details of the parameters of size and distance and what have you that I won't go into. The Code of Practice recognises that adequacy of a firefighting water supply includes not only assessment of the water supply that must be available, but also the location, connections, markings and access to fire hydrants to enable the water supply to be used. Roading, widths, services and gradients where hydrants are located are also needed to support fire service vehicles. So appropriate recognition of the Code of Practice and planning documents provides the Commission and the New Zealand Fire Service with an assurance that when fires do occur within a particular district, New Zealand Fire Service has sufficient water resources and vehicular access to protect life and property. In my opinion, these matters are a critical component in considering land development and planning. And I have to say that we already have a very good working relationship with Queenstown Lakes District Council, particularly in relation to water supplies in the more rural and rural settings, in and around the Waikato Basin in particular. The significant contribution that adequately designed water supplies and vehicle access provides to the safety of firefighters is of particular note. Failure to provide infrastructure tools to support effective emergency responses exposes firefighters to unacceptable and necessary risks and compromises their ability to perform their emergency response functions, such as entries into buildings and structures to perform rescues, limiting fire spread to neighbouring properties, in fact limiting fire spread within the buildings themselves. In my experience, early design and consideration and consultation with the fire service via the code of practice on the most appropriate firefighting water supply and access infrastructure provides dividends time and time again, and the current arrangement of PLC does that. This is the most cost-effective and efficient approach for developers and provides a higher degree of certainty for developers, home business owners, councils and the fire service. Thank you.
The one question I have is whether the fire service has any issues or concerns when consents in rural areas require landscaping and planting in and around buildings. Does that create any concern for the service?
It does. It can do. It depends on the nature of the plantings. We're really encouraging, well, particularly the rural people, the Otago Rural Fire Authority, are encouraging people to have a good-sized margin between the dwellings and the trees or the vegetation. Two areas of note would be the Alpine Retreat up in here, and Mount Iron and Wanaka is a particular concern. They are outside the fire service jurisdiction, but we've worked with the Otago Rural Fire Authority to develop a Mount Iron plan similar to the Red Zone plan in Queenstown.
Right.
The residents know that there's very little hope of saving them if a fire takes off Mount Iron.
Mm.
As do the residents of the Alpine Retreat.
Okay.
Is any of this provided in the current operative district plan? Sort of the requirements that you were seeking?
Are you able to?
I can respond.
Okay, no, thanks. In terms of the, this is the reason I'm asking the questions now, while we're not talking about the detail, but the strategic level, if we're looking at policies and objectives, then I want to try and make sure that the two marry up. What are the sort of access issues that you have that are a problem?
I guess it's more because we have a good working relationship with QLEC now, the engineering planning people are working hard to ensure that developments in the rural area meet the needs of the code of practice. And where they have some difficulties or some complexities, they bring the issues to us and we work through with them. So I'd put it in that vein. Of more recent time zone, and this is outside QLEC, we're finding in more recent subdivisions elsewhere where the streets in the new residential subdivisions are narrower. And when vehicles park on either side of those streets, we actually have no access. And an example is one in Cromwell. So, and I note that out at Lake Shotover Country that the streets are considerably narrow, but the issue has never been brought to my attention. But it's just something that we need to be very careful of, that we do in new subdivisions make provision for the access of fire appliances by perhaps restricting the parking in some way, if it's necessary to narrow the streets.
Thank you.
Question for you, Mr. McIntosh. Does your Frankton operation service the airport, or do they have their own facilities?
No, the airport have their own rescue fire team. Yes, they are a separate entity.
can you explain to me at a practical level what can actually be done in the rural areas? Presumably, you can't reticulate water everywhere, and so what in when you're seeking a policy of provide for or whatever it is at a high level, which is what we're talking about here today, provide water basically everywhere. What in practice can be done 15 kilometres that way?
Simply a water tank that contains a minimum of 20,000 litres of water, sufficiently distant from the house so it's not so that we can't get into it, with a firefighting connection that we can couple into with good roading access.
And so what you're looking at is protecting buildings. You're not looking at fires to protect forestry areas, for instance.
No, it is about protecting buildings, correct.
And would you have an issue, and I'll ask you this the same question, would you have an issue if the high-level policy were more specific about providing adequate firefighting water for protection of houses and other buildings?
But I have no protection. But can you reread that? Sorry, say that again.
So, I made it up on the fly. I'm not sure I could say it again. the sense of what I was trying to get at was to remove the implication that I currently read is that there will be a sea of water supply tanks all over the district against the possibility that a bit of bush over in the back corner of one of the large farms may go up. And so the question is, would you have a problem with tagging the kind of policy recognition, the high level, to sufficient water to protect dwellings and other buildings?
No, whatsoever.
Thank you very much.
You may be aware that there's currently a review of the forest services in New Zealand taking place, and that is from next year, almost 12 months from now, there will be one national entity. So the urban and rural requirements will certainly emerge.
Practically, when you say you need to provide a tank of 20,000 litres, is that the required that's full? Does that have to be a separate tank from what's used for domestic water?
No, not at all. The arrangement with QLEC is that the standard supply tank's about 30,000 litres, I understand, of which the council people require 10,000 for domestic water, and we ask for 20,000 for firefighting, so it's quite a convenient arrangement of the size of the tank.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a current arrangement, isn't it? And the board let me know, I guess, is to make sure there's getting the detail and having the right connections.
Absolutely. And the council planning people have worked with us to achieve that.
It's a standard condition pretty much in your areas. Just Frankton, you say that we're going to have a new station there, and your enabling suggested policy of enabling development and ongoing leasing facility. What practical kind of things would that involve?
The current site is far too small for our needs.
Yeah.
We envisage that with the growth of Queenstown, that Frankton will become the base of the fire service in Queenstown. So we are looking for a much bigger facility. With the possibility of amalgamating with other emergency services, we could end up with an emergency services site. Could involve, for example, the council's emergency operating centre. There's potential to create an emergency services site involving the services at Frankton.
So have you identified a broad policy when your actual needs are quite specific? I.e. what you seem to be saying is that the only foreseeable station development you're requiring is going to be Frankton. If it is a combined, then there would be some requirements off site anyway. Have you identified any of those?
Yes, we have. It needs to be very close to the current site. It's very sensitive to the extremities of of Lake Hayes Estate and Jack's Point and Calvin Heights. So we're actually not in, a bad spot right now, but it's very difficult to acquire land around there. So we are looking around there, but we alone would need 4,000 to 5,000 square metres without considering other organisations. So, but the emergency services in Queenstown, in this Central Otago, are very committed to working together to future sites.
Have you
given input to the subdivision
chapter?
My evidence supports the inclusion of a single objective of the two supporting policies in the strategic directions chapter. This is a refinement of the relief sought in the Commission's original submission to be fit with the form and content of Chapter 3. I don't consider that it alters the intent of the objective, but rather splits the objective and demonstrates in more detail how that might be achieved in two arms of the policy, one being in relation to things that enable the fire service activities and then enable the facilities and training themselves. The planner's report hasn't addressed the reasons for recommending that the fire service commission submission be rejected. The reason for my support of the relief sought by the commission is set out in my evidence and includes what I describe as particularly strong policy direction in the proposed RPS. In this regard, I draw your attention to Policy 3.2.7 of the RPS that seeks the reduction of natural hazard risk by, amongst other things, enabling the development, upgrade and maintenance and operation of lifeline utilities and emergency service facilities. The facilities for essential emergency services. While not operative, in the future the district plan must give effect to this policy, and I've noted in my evidence that there have been no submissions seeking significant alterations to that policy of the RPS. My evidence includes an evaluation of the relief sought by the Commission against the relevant matters in Section 32 and therefore Part 2 of the RMA. In my opinion, the proposed new objective is necessary and the most appropriate way to achieve the sustainable management purpose of the Act, because emergency services are critical to the health, safety and well-being of people and communities, and it also provides for the mitigation of what may be high-consequence adverse effects. The planner's report of 8.7 to 8.9 places some emphasis on the content of Chapter 3, reflecting a positive policy framework around enabling the multidimensional well-being contemplated by Section 5 of the RMA, and what the Fire Service Commission is seeking is quite consistent with that opinion. My evidence confirms that I've considered whether the new objective and accompanying policies are appropriate in the context of Chapter 3, and I have concluded that emergency services are sufficiently unique and intrinsically connected to Section 5 of the Act such that they would warrant the strategic approach. Such a location is consistent with the district-wide sustainable management focus of Chapter 3. It is consistent with the strong policy direction of the proposed RPS. I could go on in terms of the reasons set out by evidence, but you have read it, and perhaps I've been to spend some time addressing some of the questions that you've asked. And the first one is why is this a district council matter? And I think the answer is, particularly when you're talking about access and water supply, they're absolutely linked to land development. The risk is established when the land is developed in terms of the way in which the code of practice works. And by applying the code of practice through the district plan, it enables people who are undertaking land use developments or subdivisions to have an early understanding of what is an appropriate access design of water supply, in the same way that the council may deal with drinking water supply through subdivision and land use consent.
Before you go on, just
yes.
While that's right in your mind,
yes.
Can I suggest you think about something along the lines of bouncing off what you just said, but that rather than saying provide adequate water, something like ensure that land development makes provision for.
Yes, yes. And I've noted your comments in relation particularly to that second policy, and I take your comments on board in relation to provide, and I think ensure or require is appropriate, and something around lives and buildings as opposed to the more generic comments where you were concerned about perhaps vegetation fires as well. The current situation with the council is that there's a memorandum of understanding between fire service and the council such that planning applications are considered in relation to firefighting water supply by applying the code in a specific way that works between the fire service and Queenstown. There's really an opportunity now to, instead of dealing with each resource consent on a case-by-case basis in the long run as we get to the detail of this plan to deal with it in a more comprehensive way, which also enables the code to apply in its more general sense that offers developers the opportunity for the flexibility within the code. That enables some specific development-related consideration of how firefighting water in particular can be provided. There are other options in the code, including having less water on site but having a sprinkled building. So sprinklers is another option to achieve the code. Similarly, if there is a proximate static water supply, that's close enough to be able to provide sufficient firefighting water, that may mean that a developer isn't in a situation of having to have a tank of water on site. So those other options are available. Other questions? There was a question around is Frankton really the only issue that there's quite a lot of breadth in the first half of that policy? I think the policy is trying to achieve two things. It's, one is to deal with the future property requirements of the fire service and the fact that emergency service facilities have quite specific and important locational needs. But there's also the ongoing operation of and perhaps redevelopment of the current fire stations and the fact that they're used for training purposes, they pose drain towers, all things like that, that it would be my opinion that they should be appropriately provided for as well so that the fire service is operating in the most efficient way that benefits the community. Probably the last matter was that question around what are the genuine access issues. Parking within rather narrow streets is obviously one issue that you've already heard about in terms of fire appliance access. There's also driveway and right-of-way issues where a development is a certain distance away from a hydrant that might be provided in the street. There's a need for the fire appliance to access the property, and it's important that the width is sufficient to allow a fire appliance to access the fire risk, if you like, while connecting to the hydrant. So the code of practice, and there's another guidance document around fire appliance access, provide the guidance around how that might be achieved in those specific situations, because in a normal urban environment, the hydrant and the location of development would typically provide for the appropriate access without any further design considerations. There's also a slope issue for fire appliances and the need for gradients that allow fire appliances to access properties on significant slopes, including the transitional gradient, so that the back end of the fire appliance doesn't scrape or get stuck on the road as it accesses property. Those are some of the issues that the fire service has come across in the past, just in terms of the way in which particularly more comprehensive
subdivision
development has been designed.
I realise I may have been interrupting you.
Oh, no, that's fine. I think I've almost reached the end of some of the matters you've raised.
Well, I'm really getting the picture that there's a lot of detail that the fire service wants to get into in the zoning matters. And what we're really seeking here are the appropriate high-level policies to ensure that there is some hooks that the later stuff can come up to consider from. And it seems that the questions as to the wording of those high-level hooks, if you like, have probably all been covered today. There may be some more that I'll check with my fellow commissioners, and it might be more sensible, rather than delving into the detail of what's required, which we'll need to hear later, if we gave you the opportunity to try reframing those and that objective and those policies in the terms in a way that answers the questions that have been raised, and if you could file those within the next couple of days, that would be a sensible way forward. I'll give commissioners the opportunity to ask any further questions, but does that seem sensible from your point of view?
Yes, I appreciate that I was providing a lot of detail, which would be something like what you might hear later in subdivision chapters.
Yes.
We'd be more than happy to have redraft that and provide a more specific, focused set of policies that addresses your questions.
Just related to that, and the term of the objective, that it's worded as an objective, that's probably to make sure that sort of had a bit of that over the last couple of weeks.
Yes, it is an objective, not a policy. And policy is a policy. Not an objective.
My only other question was just in regard to, and it's probably, I don't think it's in your evidence, but rather in the legal submissions where you refer to the fact that the Christchurch Independent Hearings Panel have included that policy similar and objectives to this in the strategic directives chapter. Is there anything different that would have that panel reach that conclusion, given there's a special set of statement of ministerial explanations that we don't have that would lead them to a different reason for including it rather than what we might reach?
I can answer that. The answer is, yes, there are some. Having sat through those hearings, there are some different drivers in Christchurch given the earthquake recovery. There's probably the panel recognised the earthquake response role of the fire service, and I think that has flavoured the strategic directions objective that is included in the Christchurch decision. That said, the decision itself recognises the importance of the ongoing activities of the fire service, such that I'd probably consider it relevant here, but that relevance should be tempered by the earthquake situation in Christchurch.
Okay, thank you.
Two other drafting things for you to think about that I wrote on by margin. Your objective, provide for the health and safety of people and communities by enabling emergency services. Enabling emergency services to do what?
Yeah.
Secondly, the first policy, enable the development and ongoing use of emergency service facilities anywhere. Is this based on the discussion from Mr. McIntosh? I think as far as the location of facilities are concerned, this is an urban issue. Like, clearly they're used all over the district. And with no constraints whatsoever in the policy?
Yeah, I'm not suggesting there are no constraints, and perhaps I should reflect on the chapter as a whole and see whether the constraints need to be captured in this policy.
And also that the linkages between the objectives, and policies will still flow through to the amendments to any rules and that you're seeking amendment to make sure it stitches up, even though we're not covering that yet.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a question on clarification that raised by Mr. McIntosh, the review of the fire service, and I understand we're possibly going to one service. How does that impact on our plan? Like the question just raised by Mr. where do you provide these services? If we're having one service that's covering urban and rural, should our strategic directions cover that? I don't know whether it's a question to the chair or not.
Well, I think we'll have to see if the rural fire people have logged a submission to what they see. I'm not sure at this point.
Yeah, I'm just looking ahead if that amalgamation takes part before we've finished this review. And I don't know, I'm not sure what the rural fire submitted. Okay, something you should think about.
Finally, from the other thing just to think about is in Chapter 3, there's we've had quite a bit of discussion over the last couple of weeks regarding regionally significant infrastructure, and that maybe you should probably have a look at that and see where, given what we've heard, the fire service may or may not be considered to be in there, and just whether that then has any flow-on implications through to other policies, but also further down into other parts, just so that the whole thing's...
It's a good question, because the fire service usually gets into critical infrastructure and less so into strategic infrastructure. There's a lot of overlap between the two definitions. We can have a look at that as well.
It might also repay you sitting listening to the next spinner, who happens to be Transpower, also has a direct interest in those regionally significant infrastructure issues.
Certainly.
Sorry, can I just... One thing that we're talking about, what you might keep an eye out for, is that there is a policy somewhere, I can't remember the chapter, referring to the topic we raised before Mr. McIntosh about vegetation close, in particular to urban trees, but to rural properties and the need to think that fire can be to go to that. So maybe just put the word on that.
Ms. Manoha, I just suggest when you come back for the later hearings that you just have a slightly more realistic timing calculation. And it's gone almost 3 times what you asked for.
The questioning may have contributed.
Well, it may have, but...
Also, Ms. Aileen Corr, who's a senior planner at Becca, who has been assisting with the submissions for Transpower. We've pre-filed our evidence and yesterday pre-filed some legal submissions. I don't propose to read those out to you today, but just highlight some of the key points. So Transpower owns and operates the National Grid, which is New Zealand's electricity transmission network, and it's got some significant infrastructure assets in the Queenstown Lakes District. The National Grid is the physical infrastructure that transports electricity throughout New Zealand, as I'm sure you'll be aware of, and I'll leave that for Mr. Renton to provide further details about. Today there's really three key points I want to cover. First, the Council's obligation to give effect to the National Policy Statement on electricity transmission. Secondly, to comment on the proposed approach to having higher order and lower order chapters in the proposed plan. And thirdly, to set out why we think some amendments are required to the provisions that seek to avoid or minimise adverse effects with no other qualifier. First, I'll make some comments, though, about the legal framework, not repeating material you would have heard in the Council's legal submissions, but focusing on those legal matters as they relate to Transpower. So first, if I just cover off the National Policy Statement on Electricity Transmission. So the purpose of National Policy Statements are to state objectives and policies for matters of national significance. The NPS only applies to the National Grid, which is defined as the assets used or owned by Transpower. So it doesn't apply to distribution companies or lines owned by generators. At paragraph 7 of my submissions, I set out a number of policies that we submitted of most relevance to Transpower's submission and further submissions on chapters 3, 4 and 6. That's policy 1, so decision makers must recognise and provide for the benefits of sustainable, secure and efficient electricity transmission. Policy 2, decision makers must recognise and provide for the effective operation, maintenance, upgrading and development of the grid. Policy 3, decision makers have got to consider the constraints in terms of imposing measures on achieving, measures to avoid, remedy or mitigate effects by the technical and operational requirements of the network. Policy 5, which focuses on enabling the reasonable operational maintenance and minor upgrade requirements of the grid. Policy 8, that in rural environments, the focus is on seeking to avoid adverse effects on outstanding natural landscapes, areas of high natural character and areas of high recreation value and amenity and existing sensitive activities. And that's a point we'll pick up on later when we look at Transpower submission. And policy 10, which is about avoiding reduced sensitivity effects. That's obviously a summary of those policies, but these are set out in more detail in this cause evidence. So the Council's got to give effect to the NPS and its decision on the proposed plan. The Supreme Court obviously recently considered what this means in the context of the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement, and they held it means to implement. They noted it creates a strong directive, but obviously that depends on how specific the policy is and whether it's qualified or not qualified. The Supreme Court held that the requirement to give effect to the NPS is intended to constrain decision makers. And we submit that this statement applies equally to the NPS on electricity transmission.
Ms. Garvin, just so that you know, we've had it suggested to us that because it only applied to the coastal environment, that therefore we should doesn't necessarily apply everywhere else. Do you have a view on that?
Our view would be that the court's comments in relation to national policy statements, and particularly in terms of what it means to give effect to an NPS, apply equally to all national policy statements, and don't see any basis for limiting those comments to just the New Zealand Coastal Policy Statement.
And just to be clear, would you say the same about, given the role of this panel, would you say the same about the operative regional policy statement?
My question.
I think there's a greater question in that respect. I think the court's comments about what give effect to mean obviously have application more broadly, but as I will turn to, in fact I might just turn to this point now, I've noted at paragraph 13 of my submissions, that the council's got to give effect to the operative RPS and only have a regard to the proposed RPS. But Ms. Craw has given substantial weight to the content of the proposed RPS on the basis that the relevant objectives and policies are unlikely to substantially alter when the proposed RPS is made operative. And so I guess...
Ms. Garvin, can I just slow you up? I don't think you answered the question. My question was, your submission is that what the Supreme Court said about the CPS applies equally to the NPSET. Understand that. My question is, does it apply equally to the operative RPS?
Yes. So I think my view is that the comments around what give effect to means apply to regional policy statements. But here, I think we've got the situation where the operative RPS, I understand, is 1998. Correct me if I'm wrong, and there's a proposed RPS, which I understand decisions are imminent. So in that sort of context, you've got the proposed RPS has endeavoured to give effect to the NPS, so it would seem quite artificial to place or to not have regard to the fact that the proposed RPS is more reflective of current RMA requirements.
Isn't there a contradiction there? That I think it's academic because the discussion of the operative RPS says effectively that it doesn't say much that is directive about anything. But if there were a conflict between the proposed RPS and the operative RPS, then given the legal principles that you've just been submitting on, that our obligation is to give effect to the operative document, we would have, whatever is the proposed document would have to give way to the operative document, subject to the possible application of the exceptions the King Salmon identified.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And in that situation, though, you just end up with the council having to have another plan change to give effect to the proposed RPS once it became operative. But here, my understanding is, as you set out, that the operative RPS isn't that useful in the context anyway of regionally significant infrastructure and considering what the proposed plan provisions should contain.
At the point that it does, the proposed one becomes operative, if that's sometime later this year and this process is still going on, it would be, is it at that point we then switch?
Well, once you've got an operative RPS, you have to give effect to that document. And so just turning to paragraph 14 of my submissions, we submit that the approach Ms. Craw's taken is supported by case law, which provides that the importance of a proposed planning instrument will depend on the extent to which it is preceded through the objection and appeal process. Ms. Craw has reviewed the decisions requested in submissions on the proposed RPS and has concluded that no submissions have sought to substantially amend or dilute the policies insofar as they relate to regionally significant infrastructure. So, turning now to the relief sought by Transpower, we submit that the chapters 3, 4 and 6 contain a number of objectives and policies which do not fully achieve the Council's obligation to give effect to the NPS, which entails that they have to enable the national grid to be developed, operated, maintained and upgraded.
That's just the existing grid.
But also for future development, the NPS requires provision for the Act to recognise and provide for.
Under a separate policy under that?
I think the evidence was that there was no future expansion of the grid within this district proposed for Mr. Renton. But the suggestion was that there'd be something at Terrace which is outside of this district, that was my understanding.
I guess I'll let Mr. Renton comment on what Transpower's plans are, but in terms of this district plan, regardless, I guess, of what any intent of Transpower is at this point, the district plan still has to provide for the development of the national grid under the NPS.
Can I query that, because surely we should have regard to the evidence as to what Transpower is actually proposing within the planning period, rather than trying to provide for hypothetical possibilities like Tikiwa. The Transpower is going to extend the national grid over the Rootburn Pass to connect to Hollyford. Why on earth it would do that, I have no idea. But that's a suitably absurd possibility. That do we really have to give effect to the NPS for everything from what is actually in view to is clearly never going to be in view?
And I accept that point in terms of the district plan needs to have a practical approach in terms of, well, what is actually proposed. But I don't think that should be limited to the extent. Perhaps if I rephrase it another way, Transpower's submission and the submissions it seeks, the relief it seeks, has taken into account what future plans it may have.
Could you just clarify for me?
I understand to say I'm not sure about that, because as I read the evidence, the implications of some of the matters that were sought suggested that switching stations should be allowed in outstanding natural landscapes. Now that to me suggests that there's some proposal to have more switching stations. There's only one at Frankton as far as I know, and there's no other suggestion of others, but the policy direction that has been sought is to allow for that sort of facility, but that does not seem to align with your submission.
If it's helpful, it's really a question of horizon, and for the grid, because it's significant infrastructure, we have a plan. Our assets are indefinite when it comes to overhead lines. The assets at the stations provide us up to 60 to 80 years. The planning horizon that we look out for is nominally 30 years. It's covered in my evidence, but if we look at Frankton itself, it's moved from around 5 or 6 megawatts in 1976 through to currently 50 megawatts today. We recently completed an upgrade there about 3 years ago, and we have installed capacity there for 80 megawatts. Now, Queenstown's running at about 1.8% growth, which is higher than the national average, as is Wanaka. So we'd expect that capacity to evaporate over the next 20 years, just depending on what happens in the district. Now, the district plan will obviously have gone through two iterations since then. But if we're not careful...
No.
One, perhaps?
One?
Given how long the last one
took. It might have started.
10 years. Okay. I suppose really what I'm trying to get to, though, is that if we're not very careful right now, you will foreclose options that will enable us to either A, maximise the existing corridors and line assets so that we minimise new build as far as possible, or B, you will actually foreclose any future route into Queenstown or any other additional new stations that are required in the time horizon that's greater than about 20 to 30 years that we can see today. So it's not your problem, and it's not going to be my problem, but there will be a bunch of us sitting in this room in 25 years going, I can't get a new line route into Queenstown, I can't get a new substation built, I have demand maxing at 100 megawatts, what are we going to do? I want to shut down all those generators that are running.
Let's just go back a step though. Substations are generally not placed on the top of large hills or mountains, are they?
No, but I would regard this entire area as kind of a place of outstanding.
Well, you may regard it as that, but in fact plans show lines on maps defining where those outstanding natural landscapes are. And I'd hazard a guess that any place the Transpower chose for a substation would be outside of those. There are one or two locations beside the Karawar River that may choose, but given the 3-metre-high flood probability in those areas, I doubt that that'd be a sensible choice.
Yeah.
The issue with the lines, yes, any transmission line coming into this district is going to have to pass through some outstanding natural landscape at some point. I think Policy 8